Hello, everyone. I'm Cressida Cowell, author of How to Train Your Dragon, and I'm just popping in to tell you about my new book series, Which Way to Anywhere. It's a story about four children who discover that there are alternative worlds beyond our own, and that they can travel to them with the help of a magical map and a very special gift. Of course, this leads to epic, unexpected adventures. Which Way to Anywhere and its sequel, Which Way Round the Galaxy, are both available to buy now. Happy reading!
This is a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
All right, welcome along. I've been thinking to start, you know how it's so stonkingly hot outside at the moment? Do you fancy having a little cool down? And you can come with me on a trip to some of the most chilly but deadly places in the whole universe. It's a brand new episode of the Fun Kids Science Weekly. My name is Dan. Thank you so much for giving us a listen. This is the show that brings you everything new and amazing from the science world. Today, we're looking at a way that you can help name a robot that is going to go into space and dig up Mars. Also, we're talking about a deadly spider that doesn't like to build webs and hang between trees like normal. Instead, it scuttles around the ground, waiting to strike. And we'll chat to Fiona Smith, who is from Sea Life in Weymouth, all about the brand new home that they've built to house the smallest penguins in the world. That's on the way after we get your gadget questions answered from one of our favourite geniuses with brand new episode of Technomum.
Technomum, engineering explorers.
There's a new skate park in town with tons of ramps and even a half pipe. If you ask me, there should be one in every town. Cool it'd be if you could build a house with a skate park inside. Instead of stairs, you could have a ramp and you could use the half pipe as a bedroom.
You might have a problem with things staying put. What with all the slopes and curves?
Typical engineer.
Sorry. It's certainly an interesting idea, and thinking about better ways to build buildings and the cities around us is something a particular type of engineer gets very excited about. They're called civil and structural engineers.
Civil and structural engineers? Sounds kind of serious.
Well, building safe and pleasant places to live in is a serious job, and I bet you've tried your hand at it already.
Really? Are you sure? I think I'd remember something like that.
Whenever you play with Lego or build incredible structures in Minecraft, then you're a civil or structural engineer. Choosing the right bricks or materials for the jobs and experimenting with different designs to see what works best. Civil and structural engineers know how to make different kinds of structures in a way that makes them safe, steady and energy efficient, and able to do all the jobs that are needed. After all, if they're building a tower block, they need to make sure that the foundations are strong enough to support its weight. If it's a bridge, then they'll think about how many people might be using it and how heavy the loads on it will be. They need to understand how building materials behave so that they can choose the best ones for the job. It's a role which involves a lot of computer technology, although civil engineers often go out to the sites too to check the building works for themselves. They can give advice to people about the best way to adapt existing buildings, like converting an unused warehouse into flats. But even more exciting is that civil and structural engineers use technology in incredible ways to make smart cities.
Whoa! Smart cities? That makes it sound like the city's alive.
It's much simpler than that. To create a smart city, civil engineers use technology to collect data about what's going on. This data can be used to help make things run more smoothly. Maybe they can make traffic lights go green to speed traffic up, or help planners devise better timetables for buses and trains, or turn street lights off when there's no one around.
You're always telling me to turn my lights off when I'm not using them.
Well, it's for the same reason. Leaving lights on when they're not being used not only wastes money, but it also consumes electricity. And the more power we use, the more harm there is to the environment. Smart cities are more energy efficient.
Cool job.
There are loads of cool jobs for engineers. Almost as many jobs as there are inventions.
Like my skate park house. I think that could be a very cool invention. I just need to solve the problem of the sloping floor.
Now you're thinking.
Engineering Explorers, created with support from the Institution of Engineering and Technology to celebrate the Year of Engineering. Find out more at funkidslive.com/technomum.
I've just found probably my favourite review of the Fun Kids Science Weekly ever. Remember, if you want to get in touch with the show, the best way to do it is to head over to the iTunes podcast store, find the Fun Kids Science Weekly, drop your name, leave us 5 stars if you can, and in the comment box, type a little message, then I'll see it. Now, someone called Mostly Making has said, everything is so interesting on the show. Thank you very much. And also, they've been able to test their teachers at school. That is brilliant. That is the reason that I do this. You know, because I think one of the best parts about the show is that we learn about the science that you're not taught in class. In a sec, we'll talk about spiders that like to hide in banana plants. There's no way your teachers will tell you about that. Also, we chatted to spaceman Tim Peake on this show before. And think about it, he knows way more about space than your physics teacher ever could. And it's always fun to catch out your teachers and to give them a little test, make them the student for once, isn't it? So Mostly Making, thank you so much for letting me know about that. If you want a shout out on this show, the best way is to get over to the iTunes podcast store to find the Fun Kids Science Weekly, leave your name, drop us 5 stars, and I'll see it, and I'll give you a shout out in the next few weeks. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Now today on the show, we're headed under the ocean because Weymouth Sea Life has just opened the new Fairy Penguin Island, and Fiona Smith is a curator there. She's on the phone. Hey, Fiona.
Hello.
Hello. Very exciting. Tell me more about the fairy penguin to start.
You're right, it's very exciting. We have a colony of 20 fairy penguins. They also get called little blue penguins, and that's a little bit of a hint of what they look like. So they are the world's smallest penguin. They only get up to sort of 25 to 30 centimetres tall, and they only weigh up to around a kilo in weight, so really, really small. It's very difficult to tell the difference between a juvenile and an adult because they are so small. And again, as their other name suggests, they've got a blue tinge to their feathers, which is beautiful in the sunny sunshine that we've got just now. I'm right outside, well, within the exhibit just now with them, and they're enjoying splashing in the pool just now and enjoying the cool water in the hot sunshine. So as I say, we've got the 20. We've got a whole mix of ages in our group. We have some who are as old as 15 years, and then our youngest one, Faith, her name is, she's only 8 months just now. So quite a range in our colony as well, which is fantastic.
Now, these come from the southern hemisphere, like all penguins. They're mostly indigenous to Australia, is that right?
That's right, yes. These guys are found around the south coast of Australia and New Zealand as well, and a few islands in that area. So they're a long, long way from home. We were very fortunate to get hold of this colony. One of our sister aquariums in Australia, in Manly, sadly closed down. And so this lovely group had to find a new home. And of course, you can imagine, with them being as adorable as they are, and a real, real first as well for Europe. Well, I should say, and only at the moment. They're the only colony in Europe now. So we're lucky enough to bring them across. And they arrived with us a few months ago now, in the midst of our very cold winter.
You had to build them a very special enclosure, didn't you? What was thing that you did to build it? Because they're so far away from home, they're the world's smallest penguins, they must have some quite particular needs. What did you do to start building this thing?
Well, we did a lot of research with our counterparts in Australia, other zoos and collections who have held this species before, and also speaking with people who work with the wild birds as well. So understanding the needs, what sort of nest boxes do they need, what's the best environment for them, the best substrate, so the floor they stand on. So we spent a lot of time working with our counterparts across in Australia predominantly to look at those needs. We've had a space in Weymouth for a little while. We've got a nice building that we had and we could reutilize. We did a lot of development work from there to make a lovely indoor pool for them, some nice rocks for them inside as well, and then we're really fortunate to be able to build a nice big outdoor beach for them as well. So if you look on the internet and see lots of pictures of little penguins, you'll always see them running up from the sea up through the shore onto the sand up to their nest boxes further back. So that's what we've tried to recreate here. They also, being so small, like to hide under little things, so under bits of decking or boardwalk, things like that. So we've made sure we've recreated that in our exhibit space, giving them lots of little spaces and nooks and crannies that they can get underneath, and really does replicate what we can see in the wild.
Now, the sand, obviously down in Weymouth, one of the best beaches in England, I think, clearly wasn't too hard to get hold of. Talk to me about some of the challenges with housing these fairy penguins. So what was quite surprisingly hard about building their new habitat?
Well, as you said before, because they're so small, it does set up a whole new sort of considerations that we need to make. We've worked with penguins here for many years, but those penguins are much bigger in stature. So that consideration of little nooks and crannies that they can get into, one, we want them to go into some of them, but actually we need to make sure they can't get out as well. We don't want them to get lost wandering around Weymouth. So we've had to be very careful with our fence lines and our barriers and our walkways and where the guests can get to as well. So we've got a lovely decking that our guests can walk through and see the penguins. But again, we don't want the guests kind of sort of knocking a penguin out of the way. So they're on one side of our lovely decking perimeter fence, and then the birds are on the other. But we've also got a lovely under tunnel as well that the birds can move around the exhibit. So underneath where the guests are walking, it's the other side. And again, they are so small. We want to make sure that they're safe and secure, and that's been one of our primary. Well, that is one of our primary things we consider when we're designing new exhibits.
Now, if you can, like quite simply, can you just talk us through a penguin's day? Like what time they wake up, what they have for dinner, what they have for their breakfast? How does it work with the fairy penguins? Because they just seem like quite a singular creature because they're so small. You must have to treat them with expert care and kind of work really hard to keep them safe all day.
That's absolutely right. We have a designated penguin member of staff who will spend almost all day with these birds. So when we get in the morning, we pop in and we check that the birds are all right. Surprisingly, they're very vocal. They make a whole host of noises. When we arrive in the morning and we, you know, call in to them to say good morning, they're always shouting back, saying good morning back, and then where's my breakfast?
Fiona, what does a penguin sound like, a penguin call sound like?
Oh, these make a whole host of different ranges, from little chirps to loud sort of almost growls, and they can get really loud. I'm down at the exhibit now. I was hoping while we were on the call that they would make some noises, but they're obviously quite chilled out. They make a lot of little chirps to speak to each other, to check in. Oh, where are you? Where are you at? Who's over there? And they'll call back and forth to each other. So it's a great noise. And if any of your listeners are able to come down and visit the birds, you'll definitely hear it. It's a fantastic sound. Quite alarming as they're so small and the noise they make is so big. it's quite an odd thing to hear. We do that feed, we do the breakfast feed, they get a breakfast, they get a lunch and they get a dinner feed, and we do that in the water in the exhibit, but also out in the sandy areas as well. And we spend a lot of time tallying and checking how much birds eat, which bird is eating how much food, so we know exactly who's eating lots and who's not eating as much. And now in the summer sun as well, making sure they're properly hydrated as well, and we do that through their food too.
Brilliant. Now very quickly, it's not just fairy penguins at Weymouth Sea Life. What other under the sea beasts do you have that we can check out?
We have such an array of animals here. We've got great tropical marine sharks, we've got the black-tipped reef sharks, our big nurse sharks, stingrays, we've got our cow nose rays as well. As I said before, we've got the Humboldt penguins too. So if you're a penguin fan, we've got two colonies for you to meet. We've also got a beautiful splash pool. So as our penguins are splashing around in their pool, we've got an area for our guests and our kids to run around in and cool off in the sunshine as well. We've got sea turtles here as well, and our seals and our otters, a whole host of lovely, lovely creatures to come and visit.
Brilliant. Fiona Smith, thank you so much. We've got loads more about Weymouth Sea Life on our website, which is funkidslive.com. Yeah, go down there, check out the brand new fairy penguin island that they've got. Fiona, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
It's time for this week's Dangerous Dan, where we talk about the most deadly mean things in the world. Now, this week, we've got two of the most terrifying words in the jungle put together. Wandering spider. The Brazilian wandering spider is one of the most venomous in the world. Even its scientific name, Phoenutria, means murderess in Greek. It's big, it's brown, it's a little bit hairy, it's mainly found in South America, and its bite causes breathing problems, paralysis, and sometimes for your muscles to spasm and do whatever they want. Now, what's pretty scary is that unlike most spiders, they can decide if they want to be poisonous. Sometimes they'll bite without any toxic. Now, they're called the wandering spider because that's exactly what they do. They don't tend to make webs and hang about between the trees like other spiders. They scuttle around the floor looking for food. Now, they're also called by another name sometimes, which for me is even more scary, banana spiders. This is because they like to hide and get shade in big bunches of bananas. And sometimes those bunches are picked, they're transported, and they come here to the UK. And that means sometimes spiders are found in the most random of places, like the supermarket. Yep. Another reason to never eat fruit and vegetables. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Now, we'll talk about how scientists have figured out why snakes have barely changed in the last 100 million years in just a sec. First, let's get an episode from our speakers series. This is all about sound, it's about noise, and it's about the different ways that you can hear what I'm saying right now.
The speakers. Transmission. AM, FM, DAB.
The speakers have been looking at some radios, and they have the letters AM, FM and DAB on the dial. Wolf explains how these are different ways energy is used to transmit sounds.
AM, FM. So, what's that all about?
That's easy, Sabo. FM stands for funky music.
Oh yeah? What about AM then?
Easy. That means alien music.
Wow, I never knew aliens had their very own radio stations.
She's winding you up, Subbo. That's not what AM and FM stand for at all.
AM.
AM stands for amplitude modulation.
FM
stands for frequency modulation.
Sounds complicated. I think I've got a headache.
Blimey. Calm down. I'll explain. Imagine we were all on a boat. A lovely, relaxing boat.
Speakers should not go on boats. Water and electrical things do not mix.
It's an imaginary boat, okay? On some imaginary water.
Just saying.
Imaginary. Right. Now, if we got into trouble a long way from the beach...
Which is very likely, as we would be electrical items in close proximity to water.
Shut up! It's rude to interrupt.
Thank you, Subbo. Right, we're on a boat. Imaginary water, okay? We want to send a signal to people on the beach. One way would be to rock the boat this way, then that way, then this way, and so on. This movement would make the waves travelling to the shore much bigger. AM radio is similar. It uses energy to change the height of the radio waves travelling through the air.
So what about FM?
Well, instead of making the waves bigger, FM is like using a paddle to move the water around us, so we're increasing the number of waves travelling to the beach. FM uses energy to increase the frequency of the radio waves travelling through the air.
Oh, my head still hurts.
It doesn't really matter. The main thing is that these are two different ways of carrying a signal from one place to another. And those signals can be changed back into sounds when they arrive back in the radio.
All right, Clever Clogs. What about if an enormous family of sharks got interested in eating us for lunch and started swimming between us on our imaginary boat and the beach? Our waves would be all mixed up.
Interfering sharks. That's all we need.
Actually, you're right, Subbo.
Really?
That's right. Interference is the name we give to things getting in the way of our signals. It sounds a bit like this on FM and AM. Calm down. I said calm down. Calm down. No need to panic. There's another way of sending signals, and this way doesn't get affected as much by interference.
Or interfering sharks.
Or sharks. It's called DAB, or digital audio broadcasting. This way, sound is changed into tiny packets of computer code, and these are carried on the waves.
So, don't sharks like computer code then?
Well, it's a bit like this. If we were on our boat, we could write the letters SOS on tons of different rubber duckies and send them towards the beach. Even if some of them got eaten by sharks, people on the beach would still be able to piece together our signal SOS. Those letters are like the packets of code, which are the signals we're sending through the air.
So, I think I get it. We can use energy to send signals through the air in different ways. But there's just one thing I don't understand.
Go on.
Where do the aliens come into it all?
Speakers Transmission with support from Arqiva. Find out more at funkidslive.com/speakers.
It's time for this week's Science in the News. A creature that has been frozen in time for 99 million years has been found. It's a baby snake. It was found in Asia, and it's been encased in solid amber from tree sap. It's the very first baby snake fossil that scientists have ever found, and it shows them how snakes look and act hasn't really changed in almost 100 million years. Also, you've got a chance to name the European rover that will go to Mars in 2020. Now, currently, it's called ExoMars. It's this six-wheeled rover, and scientists want you to pick the name that it takes to explore the red planet. It's done by an online poll, but there's no option for you to pick Spacey McSpaceface, which means you kind of need to think of a more boring name. Search about that online. Finally, temperatures rising in the Arctic are making barnacle geese migrate north much quicker every year. But how exhausted they are from flying so quickly means they're too tired to lay the eggs. And that means that by the time the new chicks are finally born, it's too late to get the best food. So one little change in the Earth, like the temperatures getting warmer, means that some chicks are getting not getting enough food, and that's making them seriously unwell.
Deep Space High, the Universe Handbook, with the Science and Technology Facilities Council.
Glad I'm not on Earth today. It's terrible weather back there. Thunder and lightning. I'm soaked through because it's raining cats and dogs.
Wow! I didn't know little animals fell out of the sky on Earth. How do they get there?
Not real cats and dogs. It's just a silly way of saying it. Well, it's really raining. At least there isn't weather up here in space. It's lovely and peaceful.
Well, that's where you're wrong, Alex. Space has weather, and there's plenty of it to put in your universe handbook. If you think storms on Earth are bad, well, the storms you get in space are cataclysmic. Don't take your coats off. We're going into the eye of some of the biggest space storms to see for ourselves.
But how can there be weather in space? Space is a vacuum, a big load of nothing.
Sometimes I wonder if any of you have been paying attention at all.
That sounds exactly like rain to me.
You'd be right. It's space rain, or more accurately, a micrometeor shower. Look out of the windows and you'll see for yourselves.
Cool! There are millions of tiny particles whizzing past. I wouldn't like to be outside in this shower.
Micrometeor shower? This space rain is actually made of tiny particles of rock and metal, the remnants from the creation of the universe.
You don't get anything like that on Earth.
Wrong. Millions of these micrometeors bombard Earth every day, but burn up in the atmosphere before they get anywhere close to the surface.
Oh, right. Do they like shooting stars?
No, these are much, much smaller than those sorts of meteors.
Have you heard my joke about meteors? Why aren't shooting stars vegetarian?
Is it because they prefer meteor food?
Hey, that was my punchline.
Enough jokes. The next storm we're visiting is near to a large star, and so we need to put our solar shades on. I need to make sure the shuttle has its special shields on too. Might get pretty hot. Get ready for a solar radiation storm. Stars don't just stand still and shine, you know. They're bubbling masses of fire. Solar flares lick around the surface, and sometimes there's a coronal mass ejection where a flare breaks free, and which is what we've got coming our way. Hold tight, everyone.
We'd be fried if we were outside. We definitely don't get these storms on Earth.
Wrong again, Alex. Luckily, Earth is protected from many of these by its atmosphere, but astronauts in orbit, even passengers flying an aircraft, can be affected by the radiation in these waves. An umbrella and a raincoat wouldn't be enough to keep you safe.
Okay, sir, we get the idea. Get us out of here.
Ah, it's okay, it's passed.
Phew! At least all that space weather is far up above the Earth's surface to affect humans like me.
Sorry to say, you're wrong again there. Sometimes solar storms are so strong they can affect the Earth's magnetic field and disrupt communication systems like mobile phones and satellite navigation signals. They can also disrupt electrical power grids, causing massive power cuts. When that happens, they're known as geomagnetic storms. But it's not all bad. Take a look at this. Can anyone tell me what you see?
It's beautiful!
That's the Aurora Borealis.
Beautiful colours in the sky. You only get them near the poles on Earth.
I've never seen them in real life.
These amazing shows of light are caused by energy particles from solar rays hitting the Earth's magnetic fields. They come in all colours and can be just a few streaks or a whole sky of coloured waves. You say you've never seen them, Alex, but during a geomagnetic storm, it's sometimes possible to see them from other parts of Earth.
It would be something nice to look at until the power cut ends, at least.
Good point, Stats. That's all for today. But I hope you can see that the weather you have on Earth, Alex, isn't so bad compared to the space weather.
Yeah, I just hope it stays in space.
Deep Space High, the Universe Handbook with the Science and Technology Facilities Council.
That is it for this Fun Kids Science Weekly. A few things to point out before we go, though, very quickly. If you want a shout out on this show, or you've got a sciencey question that you want answered by a proper expert, you need to let me know. You can do that by dropping it in the comment box of a review of this show on the iTunes podcast store. Open that up, find the Fun Kids Science Weekly, leave your name, drop us 5 stars, and you'll get a shout out in the next few weeks if you do that. Also, while you're on iTunes, that's the best way that you can catch up with all the brilliant Fun Kids Science series that we've got. We've got new Technomuppet episodes on there, we've got more from the Deep Space High guys, there's also Professor Hallock's, one of my faves. He's on iTunes, he's also on the free Fun Kids app and at funkidslive.com, and you can listen to Fun Kids all over the country on your DAB digital radio on that free Fun Kids app, and as always at funkidslive.com.
So that was a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
Hello everyone, I'm Cressida Cowell, author of How to Train Your Dragon, and I'm just popping in to tell you about my new book series, Which Way to Anywhere. It's a story about 4 children who discover that there are alternative worlds beyond our own, and that they can travel to them with the help of a magical map and a very special gift. Of course, this leads to epic, unexpected adventures. Which Way to Anywhere and its sequel, Which Way Round the Galaxy, are both available to buy now. Happy reading!